Welcome to Great Australian Lives.
For Tobin Brothers Funerals,
celebrating lives. Here's your host, Laura Turner.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Well, tonight's guest is a woman who gives her all to others. She's dedicated her life to empowering and protecting women at risk, when behind the scenes, she's fought some of her own very serious battles. She's the daughter of a Holocaust survivor and a warrior against breast cancer six times over. It is my pleasure to welcome Kathy Kaplan, OAM, to Great Australian Lives. How are you tonight, Kathy?
Wonderful. Thank you for having me.
It is an absolute pleasure and an honour. You have such a story. As I mentioned in the intro, you work so tirelessly for people in the community, women especially, but you have in many different areas of the community. Take us back, first of all, to Australia Day 2011, when you were ordered that OAM. What a significant moment for you.
That was a very weird moment, actually. I was nominated without me knowing. That's the way it should be done. But as it turns out, that year I'd nominated a number of people. So the previous October is when the successful candidates are not notified, and I went to my letterbox and there's a letter from the Governor General. But I was on my way to pick up my elderly mother, didn't have time to open it, picked up Mum, threw the envelope in her lap and said, "Tell me what it said." And she said, "Who won it?" I said, and she said, "You did. I nearly crashed the car." And this is not false humility. I really, really felt at the time, you know, I don't deserve something like this. I know a lot of people who do and give a lot more, so I wasn't going to accept it. Mum at the time was still driving and still cognizant and sort of all there, and she arrived one day, put the paper in front of me, gave me a pen, poked her finger in my face and said, "I'm still your mother, sign the paper." And that's how it happened.
You have to do what your mum says, don't you, at the end of the day?
Absolutely. And if my children are listening, pay attention.
How important was that public recognition? I know you're humble, but it must be quite the shot in the arm to have those letters at the end of your name.
It was really, it's really awesome. I use it not to pat myself on the back, but I'm hoping that sometimes those letters will help me open a door. I have to say, in recent years, there have been a couple of recipients of Australia or Queen's Birthday Honours who I felt really, really uncomfortable with. And I've thought, you know, I really should hand mine back because I don't want to be in the same company as those people. Yeah. And then I thought about it more and I thought, you know, if I give it back, the only positive advantage of that is that my conscience will be relieved. It won't make a difference in community, but having those letters might be of benefit to the community in getting to talk to people who might be able to help us further.
And has it been?
I guess so, in a way. Not as much as I would like, but I would like the whole world, so, you know.
So it hasn't helped you support in getting more support for your projects? I know you're very big on fundraising.
Yes. I'm hoping it will. I live in perpetual hope. But that hope is associated with a lot of hard work. And that word work is in inverted commas because I'm not paid for this. I do this. It's a passion project.
Yeah, I know it is. And it's an incredible work you do. The way I met you was a few weeks ago and we talked about Impact for Women. That is a completely volunteer-driven charity supporting women and children in crisis, specifically women and children living in crisis accommodation as a result from fleeing extreme family violence. Tell us about Impact. How did you, how did it happen?
Okay, that's quite a story too. So we're going back to 2006. I was working very, very full time at the time. I had three children at school still. I've been a single parent since my children were 5, 3 and 8 weeks. And I was the president of a large communal organisation. My term as president came to an end, and everybody knows that it only takes you 5 minutes to run an organisation. So I had 5 minutes spare up my sleeve. As it happens, it was coming up to Mother's Day, and all I could see were billboards, TV advertisements, magazine, newspaper adverts, happy mummies getting electrical appliances and chocolates that we neither need nor want.
No, we never ask for them, do we?
No. And I thought, you know, there'd be an awful lot of us who not only don't get anything, but all of this positive advertising is actually having a detrimental effect because it's reinforcing what we've been taught to believe, that we're unlovable, that we're worthless, nobody would be interested in us. So I thought, wouldn't it be nice if we could give a token gift to these women that for half a second they think, oh my goodness, someone who doesn't even know me thinks I'm worthwhile as a human being.
That can be more meaningful, can't it? If you know, if there's, yeah, if there's people out there thinking of you who you didn't know.
Exactly. So I did some research, very poor research as it turns out, and I thought that there were 100 Victorian women and their children in hiding on any given night as a result of relationship violence. And I thought 100 was a disgraceful number, and it is. So I got 12 friends together. We got a few donations. Everything has to be new at Impact because what we do is we give gifts and services with dignity, and we give dignity with gifts and services. So it's got to be new. It's got to look lovely. We got some donations. We packed 100 little gift boxes. I got them off to the couple of refuges I knew about. Chip chop, job done. And then the thank you note started. And the one that kicked me in my belly was the one that told me this was the first Mother's Day gift she had ever received that did not include a black eye.
Oh.
And so Impact was born.
Oh, I'm going to cry. That is, that's, yeah, that must have had an impact on you.
Yeah. So, you know, so what was originally a once-off idea, let's, you know, a few of us do something nice, turned into something, and we just grew like Topsy. We grew without planning. We've only had a board for 2 years now, trying to catch up on all the things I should have done if this had been a planned endeavour. And last Christmas we had 500 volunteers helping us pack nearly 2,000 bags of love just to Greater Melbourne.
That's beautiful. So, and you call them, you know, bags of love. That is, I read an article, you were talking to someone about the day that the penny really dropped for you, and that is when you looked across the room and you saw a Muslim woman in her garb standing next to a young Jewish boy in his, working together to help the community. And is that true? Was that the moment for you?
No, that's the moment that penny dropped, that what we were doing was more than helping who we thought were the beneficiaries. The volunteers get so much out of it. You've got people all backgrounds, all ages, all cultures, all religions, leaving every agenda outside except one: do something nice for someone you don't know. And when I looked at this hijabi-wearing woman working shoulder to shoulder with this little Orthodox Jewish boy, I thought, this is the way the world should look. And there's no reason that it shouldn't, except for people's ego.
And I think, you know, we hear a lot about the bad things in the world, but your proof that behind closed doors, all of these people working together, there is so much good, isn't there?
And we're seeing that now with COVID, aren't we? All the kindness epidemics going around, the kindness groups locally, people helping each other out. And, you know, I don't remember who it was. Was it John Lennon who once was bemoaning to his mother about reading something terrible in the newspaper, and the mother said, when something bad happens, look for the helpers. Mm-hmm. There's always the helpers.
Absolutely. And it's certainly something I know a lot of people tell their children when there's bad news on TV, to try and find the positive in it. Speaking of COVID, that must have impacted what you're doing significantly, in terms of volunteering and getting together to get these bags together. And also the women that you help.
Yes, yes. So firstly, in terms of getting the bags together, of course, Mother's Day was shortly after we were all in lockdown. So we couldn't do our normal big pack where we've got 500 volunteers. But we also knew that with lockdown, everybody is more vulnerable, and especially these people, they're one of the most vulnerable groups. So we got our heads together and thought, you know, how can we still make something happen? And our community of the Impact family, if you like, the large, broader Impact family, we had lots of people who wanted to help. And then one of the families we know rang and said that they're happy for their factory staff to pack all the bags because they were allowed to go to work at the time.
Wow.
Well, with the collaboration of the police, who are great partners with us, We were able to get a lot of our goods to the factory. They packed it. And then with letters of support and comfort for volunteers, we were still able to get them out. Were the bags as big as we normally would have done? No. Were we able to get all the other stuff that we normally would have liked to have gotten out? No. But we did get 1,600 bags of love out.
Wow.
Every bag had makeup, some hygiene products, some chocolate, because there's no such thing as too much chocolate, another treat and a gift and some face masks. And I'm really proud we were able to do that. It was when I was doing that and I was saying, oh, why are we putting the makeup in the bags this time? Because I actually thought that was quite frivolous. And then I remembered last Christmas, a woman who had received a bag was speaking to me. What happens at our normal things, you walk in and there's 2,000 bags laid out. It's really confronting. And a lot of people burst into tears at that sight.
It shows the need, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And this one woman came in, she burst into tears. I was close by. We were allowed to hug in those days. So I came and gave her a big hug. And she said, I got one of those last year. And so I'm here to help. So we talked about a lot of things. And I said to her, tell me what was useful and what wasn't. And she said, oh, I loved the makeup. And then my closed-mindedness, I suppose, shone through. And I said, oh, did it make you feel better? And she said, no, Kathy, you're missing the point. It hid the bruises.
Oh.
So I don't look at makeup as a frivolous gift anymore.
Wow. I didn't even think of that.
Nor did I. And we've been including it for years. I just thought that's something nice. If the woman doesn't want it, she can give it to somebody else or a daughter or, you know, somebody else in hiding with her. It's amazing the little things you learn along the way. And, you know, it's really important. These big days, and I hope we'll be able to get back to them, apart from the fact that it'll make our task easier, it's building community. And we have lots of children. Last Christmas we had 67 kids arrive to help as well. Are children helpful? The truth is no. Do I want children there? Absolutely. The mother in me, the grandmother in me, the teacher in me says, how do we teach volunteerism other than through example? So what we do after each packing day, we write a certificate of appreciation for every single child who attends, but we don't send it home. We send it to the child's school and tell the principal what that child has done and ask the principal to present the certificate at assembly. And the kids don't know, well, the ones who've come regularly know that, but the new ones never do. And we had one policeman, his name was John, and he used to come with his little boy, Matthew. And one year he came with six kids in tow, and I said, John, where did these kids come from? He said, Kathy, they want certificates too.
That is wonderful. Kathy, are you finding at the moment, and it might be too early to tell, but given the lockdown, given that people are stressed, they're financially doing it tough, they're stuck in their homes, is the need for your services higher at the moment?
Yes. Having said that, though, in the first lockdown, the number of reporting dropped significantly. And that's understandable if you think about if you're in lockdown with your perpetrator, how do you make a call?
There's nowhere to go, yeah.
Well, you can't make a private call. Your phone is probably being managed, etc. Once the restrictions started easing it somewhat, the number of reporting to the police and to safe houses increased dramatically. So that's not a surprise. But the other issue is, of course, that all the caseworkers, they're required to work from home. So there's no more, while it's but digitally, it might be with still the perpetrator in the background. You know, it's very, very difficult situation.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tobin Brothers now offer fully live stream services so that anyone who cannot attend the funeral of a loved one can still view the service and participate. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Our guest tonight is Kathy Kaplan, OAM, founder of Impact for Women, a volunteer charity making a difference to Victorian women and children children fleeing extreme violence in Victoria. There is so much more to Kathy Kaplan, though. As I mentioned at the start of the show, she is the daughter of a Holocaust survivor. Kathy, what a story to unfold as you're a child and to learn bit by bit. Do you remember hearing about your mother's experiences, you know, in the very beginning? How did he tell a child about that?
I was blessed to choose my parents very, very wisely, and my parents knew how to talk to children in an age-appropriate way. Unlike my uncle, who didn't say anything to my cousins about anything, Mum was telling us stories along the way, but putting it in a way that wasn't too frightening. This is how we lived. They spent 9 months hiding in a roof space that was only 40 centimetres at its highest peak. Stories about that. And it put a perspective in life. She managed to always talk about the good people who were helping. And so fear wasn't put in us, but knowledge was. And it wasn't till, Mum's just turned 90, so 5 years ago when she was 85, we wrote her memoir. And that was the first time my cousins knew about what had happened to their father. And that was an important opening of discussion too. So my mother feels very blessed, and I feel very blessed that she's given my sister and I such an open-minded view to others and to their suffering, and to appreciate goodnesses that we see, that we receive, and the responsibility we have to give.
Correct me if I'm wrong, your mum has a bit of a different story, doesn't she? She fled, or she managed to escape through the help of others. She wasn't sent to a camp, was she?
She was in a labour camp for a while, but not in a death camp. But they were able to come out of that because of my grandmother's proactive behaviours, and my grandfather was seconded to become chief engineer for President Tissot at the time. So they were released from the camp for that purpose.
I find these stories just, harrowing, of course, but so fascinating as well, that people survived such an intense, unbelievable time in our history. It must be very important to you to keep that going so that we never forget.
Absolutely. And it's what keeps me going in this time too. Separation from family and friends is really, really tough. But I've got a roof over my head. I've got food in my belly every day. I've got heat, and I've got communication devices. I'm doing really well.
Do you ever think back to your mum's childhood when, in terms of keeping yourself grounded?
Oh, often. Often. And there's a story before my family was arrested. Mum was 13 when they were arrested, that I suppose underpins my motivation of my requirement to myself, I suppose, of doing whatever it is I can to help whenever I can. And we all do that, and we all do it to the best of our abilities. But what drives me is the story that before they were arrested, something my grandfather did. Where my family was living was in a town called, or village, as my father used to call it, and yes, it was a village. Mum calls it a city, but it wasn't, which was only 20 minutes away from Auschwitz. And that was the last transit stop before Auschwitz. And my grandfather got a group of his friends. They bribed the Red Cross for their armbands. They took off the yellow stars, put on their armbands, went to the transit camp to empty the shit buckets from the trains and to give the prisoners fresh water for the last leg of their journey. And I figure if they could do that, then I can do more of what I'm doing now.
Absolutely. What a story. I've been to Auschwitz, and not this is about me in any way, but, and I don't know if you've been there, but I, after being there, went into town, into Krakow, and just cried for 2 hours, just alone. It's the most harrowing place on earth. And I can't imagine what it would be like for someone who has a real connection to that story.
And when you and I were there, there was grass. Think about that. There wouldn't have been grass then, because any blade of grass would have been picked and eaten. Again, everything is relative. My family, we lost 39 people in Auschwitz, 39 people that 5 years ago Mum could still name. you know, but my immediate family didn't experience that. But that's the truth in any disaster, including COVID. And it's not a matter of one hardship is worse than another, because that whatever hardship a person is experiencing, that's hard for them at that time.
Yeah, that is right. Now, you, as a young woman, were a teacher. Was that always within you? Did you always want to be a teacher? How did that happen?
Yes, I loved school, absolutely loved school. Of course, I grew up in a time where you were either going to be a teacher or a nurse or a hairdresser. So I always wanted to be a teacher, except for 5 minutes, which has bitten me in the backside for the rest of my life. And that 5 minutes was after I finished my Form 6, as it was then, Year 12.
Yep. And sound like my mum.
Oh, thanks for making me feel good.
Sorry.
And they had something called Commonwealth Scholarships then, where you could be bonded to the state if they put you through university. For 5 minutes, I thought, do I want to live in the country without knowing anybody by myself for 3 years? So I declined the scholarship. Immediately regretted it, but went on and became a teacher. And that's my calling. Mm. You know, to see the light, whether it's in a classroom, whether it's talking in a conversation with people, light shine in somebody's eyes. Oh, my God, I get that. You know, it's really cool.
What subjects were you teaching when you were teaching?
I was a maths English teacher, mainly maths.
Maths and English. That's,
I know it sounds
Jekyll
weird.
And Hyde to me.
It's to most, but I liked maths, but I wasn't brilliant at it. And I taught maths like a language.
Right.
And I could make it relatable. So it was really interesting. At the end of my schooling, one of my maths teachers, who I won't name, who I actually liked, but I was scared of her, told me, "Kathy, you're a lovely girl, but you won't amount to anything." Mm. 10 years later, when we had a reunion, she said, "Kathy, what did you end up doing?" And I looked her in the face with a smile and said, "Mrs. Mm-hmm, I became a really good maths teacher."
Ah.
Put that in your pipe and smoke it, teacher.
Yeah. I did most of my teaching in far north Queensland, in Townsville and Cairns.
I was just going to ask you about that. You were working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander adolescents.
Amazing experience, a very difficult experience, especially in the very early 80s. All of Australia was very, very racist, and far north Queensland more so. In fact, getting a job was difficult because A, I was a woman, B, I was married, and C, I was Victorian. You know, I almost felt like I needed immunisation certificates to prove I'm not an alien. But that was a really fascinating experience. I learned so much. It's the first time it came into my consciousness, because I met most of the children came from families of 14, 15, 16 children. You know, it was a whole new thing. It was just a wonderful time. Even the time that a knife was drawn on me, I look back as a really, really good time in retrospect. That was a bit scary. I was on bus duty and I was walking down the back paddock and two big boys were playing fisticuffs. I was 22. What does a 22-year-old know? You walk up to them, put your hand out and say, "I'll have whatever that is." And suddenly there's a knife brandishing in my face. I thought, stuff this bus duty for a joke. So I turned around, went back and spoke to the principal. He thought it was funny. I went home and was really scared. And in those days, I was terribly shy. I was also the only woman in my staff room and at least 20 years junior to the next person in age. On Monday morning, I was even quieter than usual. And the guys asked me what's wrong. I told them the story. In unison, they stood up and walked out. They came back a little while later and said, "We've just seen the boss and told him that if the police are not here in 5 minutes, the whole staff is on strike." A few minutes later, the sirens are rising, all the kids are at the window, and I'm thinking, I'm not sure this is a really good idea. And they took the two boys away, who thought it was a big joke, until their mothers arrived at the police station and started chasing them around the table. So just before lunch, one of the boys, whose name was Vern, he was a really big boy. Yeah. And a big man. He was only 15, but he was huge. burst into my room and said, Miss, me mum says I've got to apologise. So, okay, so he turned around to go and said, no, hang on a second, I haven't milked this yet, so I made him apologise properly. Burst back in again and said, me mum says I've got to have a note saying I apologised. So I said, okay, come at the end of lunchtime and I'll give you a note. End of lunchtime comes and goes, no Vern. End of period eight, just before the day finishes, he bursts into my room, where's me note? And I said, Vern, I said lunchtime, you'll have to wait till tomorrow lunchtime. In a very quiet voice, he said to me, but miss, me mum will kill me. Now, this boy was the youngest of 15. He was really bright, but he saw no future for himself. Every single sibling was in jail.
Oh.
And I really liked him. You know, he was, and I spent a lot of time trying to encourage him. And when I became obviously pregnant, he was the one, miss, do you want to check? Can I clean the blackboard for you? Are you going to name the kid after me, miss? You know,
good on you, Vern. You
know, yeah. You know, I don't know what happened between those two, but he was a good soul. I don't know what's happened to him, but I hope he made something of himself.
Wouldn't it be so wonderful to hear what's happening with Vern now? Well, this is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And in these challenging times, Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. And there is more with Kathy Kaplan when we return.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Now, Kathy, while doing all of this incredible work, you've also raised your own family, and you mentioned before, which I didn't have time to chime in on, you started Impact for Women when you had three children.
I've been a single mum since my kids were 5, 3 and 8 weeks. They were all teenagers when I started Impact.
Well, that's enormous in itself. You must be very proud of your three children. You've had a journey of your own, being a single mum with them being so young. And you're a grandmother as well.
Yes.
You know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I know that you are of the Jewish faith, and that is a very tight-knit community, and family is very important, aren't they?
Very important. My son and his wife and my two little grandsons, they live in the Gold Coast, so I don't see them very often at all now. I wasn't seeing them very often before, but, you know, incredibly important.
Yeah. And how important has your family support been over the years? I mean, you must have had some good understanding kids while you're out working for Impact for Women.
They didn't know any different. They came and helped. That was part of life. That was part of life. You know, we didn't see that as work. You know, my work at school was my work. And that was what we did as volunteers.
Yeah. Your mum too, I know you said she's just turned 90, is that right?
Yes.
Are you struggling to see her at the moment?
It's really difficult. She's now in an aged care facility who are looking after her beautifully. But with the lockdown, we've only been allowed to see her for half an hour every fortnight. And, of course, now we're not allowed to see her again. And she's used to seeing me at least once a day, every day for the last 5 or 6 years. It's quite difficult, but it's necessary. And she's wonderful. She is suffering from dementia, but she has moments of absolute clarity. And when we talk about it, and she just, again, from the Holocaust experience, she says, I accept what is happening and look forward to a better time.
Does she understand? I mean, it sounds like she does understand what's happening. Does she understand when she doesn't see you as much and why?
I have to remind her of why. So every day she rings me and says, I need some more lipstick. Can you get it for me? Can I need this? Can I say, no, I can't, because, and then she remembers. So she needs reminding. She's just awesome. She's just awesome.
And you mentioned earlier on that you wrote her memoirs, and I know that that was something you did just for the family, but it ended up being something that other people were interested in as well.
That's right, yes, which is lovely. It was really for the family, but, you know, I think we all need to learn from history and the terrible things human beings can do to other human beings, because if we don't learn about it, if we don't teach about it, we're more prone to repeat it.
Absolutely, yeah. And is that a book that's available at the moment? I mean, if people are interested in hearing it, can they buy it?
Yes, they can. If you go to Amazon, You can buy it from Amazon, both in soft copy and in hard copy. And it's accessible. It's not a writing book. It's called Zahor, I Remember, Will You? So if you just type in I Remember, Will You? And put my name, you'll find it.
As we mentioned earlier too, you are a six-time breast cancer survivor, which is mind-blowing in itself. When was the first time, and how did that happen?
My children were 8, 6, and 3. I'd been separated already for a number of years. I met a man, the only other person I've had a relationship with, and I thought at the time, don't be stupid. You know, don't know where this is going, go and get on the pill. So I went, no, I got topped and tailed and I got put on the pill and that's all fine. A week later, I'm in the shower and I go, oh, what's that? And there's a little lump. And I thought, oh, that's the pill. You know, that's hormonal. I'll watch it for a couple of weeks. I think that watching lasted about half an hour. And I rang my doctor and said, look, I found something. Can you just have a look? You need a look. And he rang, got me to have a mammogram. They did a mammogram, didn't have ultrasounds at the time. I'm waiting there for the mammogram person to come through. You're sitting there for ages. You think they've forgotten you and you're thinking all sorts of things. And I'm convinced this is just hormonal. And the lady came in and said, look, we've just spoken to your doctor. It's 7 o'clock at night now. He's waiting for you. And I thought, that's not good. Mm. Went straight to my doctor. He said, I've made an appointment for you to see a surgeon tomorrow. I went to see the surgeon. He did a biopsy, a needle biopsy. He said, look, I can tell this is not so good. But I said, you're still sending it to pathology, aren't you? And he said, yes. And he said, go and we'll do surgery next week. And I thought, oh, God, you know, I'm very organised in many ways. My personal desk is the most disorganised spot on the planet. Thought, just in case, I better get my papers in order. You know, I've got three little children. Yeah. So anyway, I had the surgery. It was a lumpectomy, only a lumpectomy. It was a big man's handful. And I had chemotherapy and radiotherapy. What was really interesting at the time, looking back, is how things have changed, not just medically and technically, but in society. So this is nearly, Lisa's nearly 31, so we're nearly 28 years ago. We didn't talk about breast cancer. In fact, the Breastfeeding Association was still called the Nursing Mothers Association because the word breast was not
allowed. Can't say breast.
Correct. So you couldn't talk about it, and I felt guilty. How stupid is that? That I had it, but nobody came to take my children to play. Nobody came to take my children to go to school. God forbid, I might sneeze on them and they'll catch it. Mm. Now, hasn't society changed? Because I and others started openly talking about our journeys, people started becoming aware, and with awareness comes response and money and research and society's changed attitudes. Nobody would experience what I did then, now.
Yeah.
And I think the same happens with relationship violence. I think we're in that talking phase now. What used to be domestic, behind closed doors, secret, we're now talking about. And the more we talk about it and the more we realise this is affecting 1 in 3 women, if it's not you, it's probably someone you know, but you don't know that you know.
Yeah.
Then we can start making inroads in fixing the problem. So that was my first one. My doctor told I don't like surprises. I work on better on tell me the worst case scenario. I'll work out a way I'm going to deal with that, and anything will be a bonus, a gift after. So don't tell me I'm going to wake up with 3 tubes if I'm going to end up with 10. I asked him what my prognosis was. My eldest was 8. He told me I would unlikely live to see my child become bar mitzvah at 13. I looked at him and told him that I would be too busy to think about dying. I still see that man every quarter. I poke my tongue out, blow a raspberry and say, told you so. And we're great friends. And I've told him he's never allowed to retire, never. He's the most stable man. He's the only stable man in my life, and he's the only one interested in touching my breast. So he's got to be around for it.
He's got to be around then. Now, you do some incredible work supporting other women who go through that breast cancer journey. You just don't stop, do you? I mean, imagine revisiting the sadness and the fear that you went through other women. You're an incredible lady.
No, it's not that at all. It's, you know, I was helping a lot of other single mums who were going through their journey. And like I was at the time, I was blessed to have a wonderful family, but many don't. And they need someone to talk to, somebody who's been through it, somebody who, you know, I call myself a stubborn bitch. I'm not giving up, right? You know, and to give hope, to hold a hand. I think the hardest moment was the one where there was a woman who was dying and she really had no one. And it was either me who was going to hold her hand when she died or a medical staff person, and she asked me to stay and I did. And that was a real privilege.
That sounds like an absolute privilege, a privilege. Another privilege that you have is preparing those who have passed away for burial.
I'm part of a small team of volunteers who does that for our part of the community, yes.
That in itself is must feel like an honour.
It absolutely is. When I first put my hand up, I was anxious the first time, and I'm anxious every time I arrive. But as soon as we approach the lady concerned, I don't know, you melt, and I find myself stroking her hair and stroking her arm and giving her comfort. I mean, that's ridiculous, really, cognitively. But that's how it is emotionally. And it's a real privilege to treat her with gentleness and with respect, that she still matters.
I won't go on about myself, but I had a sister who passed away, and I often think of the coroner who looked after her, I guess you could say, in the end. And I've always wanted to personally say to that coroner to thank her, because I'm sure she would have treated her with dignity and respect. And for a family member, I think what you do is so important, to know that the last moments were with someone who, you know, respected their body and like you said, stroked their hair. It's just a beautiful thing you're doing.
We, you know, we work in a team of four or five of us together, and, you know, that's how we all feel. That's, you know, we wouldn't have put our hands up if we didn't. And that's how I want my mother to be treated. And that's how I hope I will be treated when it's my turn.
That is just beautiful stuff. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And in these challenging times, Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au, and more with Kathy Kaplan, OAM, in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
We've been talking with Kathy Kaplan OAM, the founder of Impact for Women, a volunteer charity making a difference to Victorian women and children fleeing extreme violence in Victoria. But she is a woman of so many other layers. We've talked about how she is the child of a Holocaust survivor. She's a six-time breast cancer survivor. She's got three children of her own. She respects and helps prepare those who've passed away for burial. Is there anything that you don't do, Kathy?
I don't clean very well.
Neither do I.
That was something I was going to ask you about, actually. In the back of your mother's memoirs, which we mentioned before, I understand there are recipes. And I was so interested in hearing that, because I have a real struggle with my two children who don't eat anything that I make them. They throw it literally in my face. And I thought to myself, do you know what? I'm going to try that. I'm going to look up that memoir. I'm going to look at those recipes and see, maybe there's a part of them that's Jewish and they want to eat Jewish food.
Worth a try. What can you lose?
They must be family recipes, are there, in the back of the book?
Yeah, they were our favourite recipes that we asked Mum to. And at the time, she made me do them as she was telling her, so I could write down, because she would say a little bit of that. And I said, well, what does a little bit? That means nothing, you know. And I had to redo things several times till she was satisfied that I'd done them well enough.
Now, as we mentioned, you have three children who are adults now. Have they followed in your footsteps with teaching and volunteering and that sort of thing? What are they up to?
I've raised three warriors. My eldest son is a paramedic. My middle son.
The most honourable job you can do, if you ask me. I don't know how they do it.
My middle son, who there's a huge story behind him, but we won't have time today, is a policeman. My daughter helps people with mental health issues.
You've just ticked every box. That is incredible. How proud.
I'm very
proud of you. Yeah. They would connect in well with the volunteer work that you do, that have such an understanding of the women that you help who are fleeing fleeing relationship violence. I can imagine the stories around your dinner table.
They do now as adults, as professionals. But, you know, volunteerism was just something we did always since they were little. That was just... That's part of life, just like you go to the toilet and you brush your teeth, you volunteer.
Speaking of that, what does 2020 hold, or even going into 2021, for you and Impact for Women? What's the next step for you and the organisation?
Okay, the big thing that I'm looking at the moment is continuing and expanding our court childcare program. It came to our attention last year that in Moorabbin Court there's no childcare. So if a woman's babysitting falls through or she can't get childcare, she either has to not turn up and that pisses the court off and extends her journey, or she goes, the child is tugging at her all day, she can't focus on what she needs to focus on, the child has to hear the story again. They're in a huge, vacuous, child-unfriendly area for hours with their alleged perpetrator just metres away. So together with the police and a local refuge and with the court's blessing, we established free childcare for those women on those days at the court. Moorabbin Court, because of COVID, now has extended Family Violence Day to Friday, so we need to extend it. And other courts around the state are desperate for us to share that too.
I've sat in courtrooms for years as a news reporter, and you often will glance over at the poor woman with the crying baby in the corner, or even worse, toddlers, and they're there, as you said, for hours. And I've often wondered what's the solution, and you've just put it in a nutshell.
The only thing that's holding us back is money. We are tax deductible, guys, so, you know, and that's what we're directing our funds to at the moment.
Well, if you're listening tonight and you want to help Impact for Women, you can visit impactforwomen.org.au. I'm sure volunteer hands are always helpful, but at the moment with COVID, you could never turn down a cash or, you know, monetary donation, I'm sure. Kathy Kaplan, am I right?
Thank you. Absolutely.
Thank you so much for being on the show. It has been an absolute pleasure. You've led an incredible life. Thank you.
Thank you for the privilege of having me. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed our chat with Kathy Kaplan OAM tonight and you'd like to share it with a friend, subscribe to the Great Australian Lives podcast. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And in these challenging times, Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to a loved one. And of course, join me the same time next week when we celebrate another Great Australian Life.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.